Hello and welcome to Don't Miss a Beat, presented by Inside Cardiology. Don't Miss a Beat is a monthly podcast hosted by myself, Dr. Stephen Green, and Dr. Muthu Vadaganathan, providing a regular news roundup of the latest evidence and clinical trial insights across cardiovascular, renal, and metabolic diseases. Hosted by practicalcardiology.com, Don't Miss a Beat is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Welcome back to Don't Miss a Beat, hosted by myself and my good colleague and friend, Dr. Steve Green. We're so excited in the wake of ACC 2022, the first large global meeting that was had a very substantial in-person attendance. There was tons of excitement, enthusiasm about the fields of cardiorenal metabolism. And most importantly, one major set of guidelines that was released, the American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology, and the Heart Failure Society of America joint heart failure guidelines were debuted at the Scientific Congress and generated a ton of enthusiasm. So we hope to focus this episode of Don't Miss a Beat on dissecting some of the intricacies and details of those guidelines and juxtapose them against the other major global set of guidelines, the European Society of Cardiology. Before we get started, I just want to lay the foundation. Why are these global guidelines so important? Certainly, the ACC AHA guidelines, as well as the ESC guidelines, are perhaps the most prominent guidelines, but it's important to recognize that there are a number of other regional and country-specific guidelines worldwide. Many actually look to the ACCHA and ESC guidelines for their own guidance. Furthermore, we know that these guidelines influence individual clinician decision-making, even after pivotal trial reporting. Furthermore, payer and insurance coverage decisions may be influenced by these guidelines. So the actual written language in these guidelines is of paramount importance in guiding how care is actually delivered and ultimately implemented in practice. So Steve, why don't we get started? What's top of mind in terms of look over in terms of the guidelines?
Well, thanks Muthu, and I totally agree with you really setting the stage nicely there with the importance of these guidelines. And also, you know, the timing, you know, came out as we're all getting ready and packing up for our trip to Washington DC for ACC. We have the guidelines come out and it really made for great conversation with all the colleagues at the conference. But to jump right in, so I think one of the main takeaways from these new guidelines is that we now have a very strong emphasis on quad therapy for patients with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. We were all expecting SGLT2 inhibitors to have a strong place in these new guidelines, and it starts right with HFrEF class 1A for reducing cardiovascular mortality or heart failure hospitalization. And the guidelines notably say, irrespective of type 2 diabetes status, to just remind us that these are no longer diabetes therapies only, but they really are heart failure therapies, irrespective of type 2 diabetes. But when you look at the now the new guidelines for HFrEF, you see really all four of the pillars are represented with class 1A recommendations. But a couple other take-home points aside from the SGLT2 guideline that I'll give my perspectives on, then Muthu, it'd be great to hear from you as well. One noticeable piece of language in these new guidelines is respect to ARNI for HFrEF and how, you know, the former guidelines talk about ACE and ARNI, and they talk about switching downstream from an ACE to an ARNI if people are still symptomatic. But these guidelines are more explicit in their language. They talk about ARNI, and then they talk about ACE inhibitors to be used if ARNI is not feasible. They use that very specific language. So to me, really gets around some of this confusion over which one should be preferred, which one is really our first line therapy. And again, talking about ACE inhibitor when ARNI is not feasible, but to try ARNI first is my take home message. But Muthu, any other thoughts you have on quad therapy language and what these new guidelines include for that?
No, I 100% agree with your perspectives on the differentiation between ARNI and ACE. And I do wonder in the ESC guidelines whether that type of language is reflecting ease of access to these therapies and attempting to be more global and reaching a broader population, including patients that may not be able to afford or access ARNI. However, I think that's actually a distinction worth noting and whether guidelines should be actually just clearly well aligned with what's best in terms of scientific evidence versus what is more practical in clinical practice. The other aspect that I think is one important difference between the two sets of guidelines is the distinction between class-related recommendations and drug-specific recommendations. The European Society of Cardiology did outline specific recommendations for the two SGLT2 inhibitors that have the more robust evidence base for in chronic heart failure, and that's empagliflozin and dapagliflozin. However, it's notable that the AHA/ACC Heart Failure Society of America guidelines preference more class-specific guidelines and offer that the SGLT2 inhibitors as a class may be recommended in this setting. You know, across heart failure, for each of the therapeutic classes, we go a little bit back and forth. ACE inhibitors and ARBs, we allow all therapies to be used. Beta blockers, we're quite specific. We say that there are evidence-based beta blockers that are recommended. MRAs, generally, we preference the steroidal MRAs, including spironolactone and eplerenone. And of course, there's only one ARNI, sacubitril valsartan. So I think that this distinction is important because ultimately in clinical practice, clinicians, payers may be wondering, well, what about canagliflozin? What about ortoglyphosin? What about therapies that aren't even marketed? And how do we actually understand utilization of those therapies in a if class-based recommendations are offered?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think this question of class effect versus specific medication effect has been something that heart failure has been talking around for a long time, you know, specifically with you focused on the three evidence-based beta blockers in the U.S. guidelines is one of the more extreme examples. But yeah, it's really remarkable. You know, the same set of evidence here being looked at in the Europeans, you know, specifically named DAPA and EMPA by name, whereas the U.S. guidelines just use this blanket term SGLT2 inhibitor. So again, it just shows that even among global experts, you know, interpreting the data and talking about class effect versus specific medication effect still remains a matter of debate. But yeah, so super very, very interesting to see that distinction between the two guidelines. And I think that also nicely, you know, sets the stage for what about the other ejection fraction phenotypes, because SGLT2s often are now, you know, recommended for those patients as well. And again, even here, use the term SGLT2 inhibitor, not naming specific medications by name in our patients with ejection fraction more than 40%. So Mutu, what were your big take-home points now for the recommendations for mildly reduced and preserved ejection fraction? Because these certainly drew a lot of headlines as well.
Thanks, Steve. You know, left ventricular ejection fraction remains our primary way to phenotype and individualized care in heart failure, and that really was an important aspect in both clinical practice guidelines. Importantly, now prior iterations of guidelines have now been updated, so slight updates in terms of nomenclature of what we call this middle category. Before, it was called mid-range, borderline ejection fraction. Both guidelines have now come together as mildly reduced ejection fraction. And I think that amongst this category, SGLT2 inhibitors have really risen to the top as a 2A recommendation. Both pivotal randomized clinical trials evaluating this population evaluated EFs across the range, the spectrum of LVEF. And then the guidelines, both sets of guidelines emphasize that combination medical therapy, so-called quad therapy, may actually be also beneficial to a higher ejection fraction, including this mildly reduced range. And I think that the evidence will continue to evolve as we have trials that will report in the next 1 to 2 years that evaluated specifically this population. I think will converge on some consensus that where to actually draw the line, And should we actually just more globally call this population heart failure with any reduction in EF or heart failure below normal EF? So I'm very curious about your take on heart failure with improved EF. What is your clinical practice in terms of how you approach these patients and how did the guidelines line up?
Yeah, I mean, this comes up all the time. And when patients have you for celebrating that improvement in the ejection fraction, and the first question patients often ask is, well, can I stop some of these medications? And I think the field was really informed a few years ago when we had the TREAD-HF trial presented and published in The Lancet, which really showed there is a cost to stopping these medications after you have an improvement in ejection fraction, and in the sense that high chance of relapse of the reduced ejection fraction phenotype. So I think now it's very good that the guidelines now make this an explicit recommendation, one, defining this improved ejection fraction phenotype, but then specifically calling it out with a guideline recommendation to continue the medications to decrease risk of a recurrent HFrEF. So it's really a welcome addition to the guidelines.
Absolutely. And, DELIVER is the pivotal randomized clinical trial evaluating dapagliflozin in heart failure with mildly reduced and preserved ejection fraction. It's including about 1,100 patients who have this improved EF. So the first real large randomized clinical trial, outcome-driven trial, evaluating this improved EF category. So we'll answer the critical question, even after you improve your EF, should you continue to optimize guideline-directed medical therapy as if these patients continue to have persistent clinical risk and treat them very similarly to their HFrEF counterparts. So we finally have a clinical practice guideline recommendation for pharmacological therapy at a high level for so-called HFpEF, or EF above or equal to 50%. And that's the SGLT2 inhibitors that have now been added based on the EMPEROR preserved data. So Steve, I'm going to ask you a very perhaps controversial question. The guidelines offered a 2A recommendation, so could be considered in select scenarios. But many may have wondered whether the guidelines should have offered a higher level of evidence, perhaps even a 1B recommendation based on the single randomized clinical trial. What's your take? Do you think the guidelines got it right? Do you think that we need more evidence to actually propel and really upgrade SGLT2 inhibition in this context?
Yeah, no, I'm happy. I appreciate you putting me on the spot. But I'll say that I was surprised with the 2A, just to be totally honest. I was expecting a 1B class 1 indication level evidence B, saying there's only one randomized trial. On one hand, just by having it be a 2A, to me, it essentially says that, we weren't necessarily impressed with EMPEROR preserved by the guideline writers. And on one hand, you can point to trials that have mostly focused on hospitalization reduction for the primary endpoint, like evabradine and HFrEF. And that was a primary endpoint was met in the SHIP trial, but it was driven by heart failure hospitalization. That has a class 2A recommendation. So then you look at EMPEROR preserved, similar kind of readout for the primary endpoint, in terms of the magnitude of risk reduction driven by heart failure hospitalization. So maybe you could rationalize, well, that's why this gets a 2A. But I also think we need to keep in mind, what the other options are in HFpEF and what are, the competition stands in HFpEF versus HFrEF. HFrEF, there's multiple therapies proven to reduce mortality. Whereas in HFpEF, this trial really stands alone. EMPEROR preserved is the first definitively positive trial, both for the primary endpoint and both pre-specified secondary endpoints. I mean, it's a floridly positive trial when you look at it that way. In a space that really hasn't had much success. So it'll be interesting to see how others respond to this and whatnot. But, class 2A recommendation is certainly a welcome improvement. We're glad to have SGLT2 inhibitors in the guideline. But I think there were some thoughts that maybe this could have warranted a class 1 And we'll look forward to seeing what Deliver adds as well when that comes out. But Mutu, I'm going to put you right back on the spot, my friend. What do you think of class 1 versus class 2A for SGLT2 and above 40% ejection fraction?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I too was expecting a 1B recommendation. I think that we have a very solid clinical trial that had robust benefits across multiple domains and should support a high level recommendation. Now, I do think the background landscape of available therapies is important to consider in guideline recommendations, because ultimately it's the patient in front of you that you're treating. And so what we're trying to do with guidelines is offer clinical practice guidance for that situation. So how do you actually manage that patient? And in a landscape in which there's a clear unmet need without any clear definitive positive outcomes trials, I think this should have risen to the very top and offered a 1B recommendation that hopefully could have been substantiated or corroborated with Deliver data and then solidified a really 1A recommendation in the field. We'll see how things evolve with newer data presented later this year with Deliver. So I want to shift gears to one very novel and innovative aspect of the AHA-ACC-HFSA guidelines, and that was related to value statements. The guideline set put forth high, intermediate, and low economic value in terms of the health system for various interventions, whether those are medical therapies, whether those are device therapies, or even other interventions. I thought it was a fascinating move, because it actually helps bridge the gap between previous just overview and synthesis of clinical evidence to then trying to understand how these can be implemented, how these could be potentially covered and paid for in practice. So as a high level, at least my overview was that several components of traditional core guideline-directed medical therapies were offered high economic value, including ACE inhibitors, ARBs, ARNI, beta blocker, MR antagonist. Interestingly, the SGLT2 inhibitors were offered an intermediate value that was based on two cost-effectiveness analyses that placed the actual ICER in this intermediate range. And that was based on the early clinical trial evidence and cost-effectiveness assessments. Furthermore, some therapies were offered low economic value, including tafamidis. And so I'm curious, this obviously is a very new aspect in the clinical practice guidelines, and it'll take some time for the community at large to actually digest this information. But I'm curious, how is this actually going to influence practice? Do you think it'll actually influence individual clinician decision-making?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, how are these new value statements actually going to be directly applicable to the clinician-patient interaction? And, you know, my personal view on these value statements is that they have the biggest impact more on a societal level, and then also potentially as a direct message to various sponsors and companies manufacturing drugs and devices on where the academic community and the heart failure community kind of sees their intervention. But on an individual provider and patient level, you know, I think we have the traditional guideline recommendations that are focused on the science in terms of what we need to do for our patient-provider interaction. You know, value is something that, you know, on a whole, a therapy might be intermediate or low value, but if the patient in front of you is, it's readily affordable and accessible and has great scientific evidence, even if something is, you know, intermediate value, it's of high value to that individual patient. You know, so I think to me, that is the main message from these value statements, is that I think they have probably the biggest impact on a societal level, you know, sending a message to, you know, companies and sponsors on where their therapy is priced potentially compared to where the academic community potentially sees it. But the other thing I'm interested to see, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts too on these value statements in terms of the implications of including these, you know, in writing, very clear language in the guidelines. is, you know, what is the downstream effects of on the heart failure community and the different stakeholders going to be? You know, on one hand, I could see this from a payer perspective almost being more ammunition to say, to justify why not covering a therapy that has strong scientific evidence if it's deemed, you know, intermediate value. So you could argue could paradoxically make things worse from that perspective in terms of coverage. Or it could have the benefit of potentially having, you know, pharmaceutical companies or device companies, you know, lower prices, which would be a favorable effect. But I'm not sure which way this is going to go, but I'm curious, Muthu, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree, Steve. You know, unfortunately, in the United States, we don't have a comprehensive high-level body that oversees cost-effectiveness analyses in a systematic way. And that's unlike countries like the United Kingdom, in which there are standardized processes in place to evaluate each and every intervention and offer a standardized assessment on cost-effectiveness and value. Here, we're relying on individual cost-effectiveness analyses that may have been conducted in different settings by different groups. And I think that does introduce some variability in these assessments. So comparing, for instance, a high-level economic values therapy versus an intermediate one may not be an apples-to-apples comparison. And that actually does become problematic if we're talking about, for instance, coverage decisions between these two potentially highly effective therapies. So I think that this does push us in the direction, if guidelines are going to move in this direction, I think we need to take a step back and actually standardize our, in the United States, our evaluation of cost effectiveness and value overall. So I know we're just about at time. I think it would be a huge gap if we do not discuss upstream information about prevention of heart failure. The ACC-AHFSA guidelines, as well as ESC guidelines, have now come together in standardizing our staging of heart failure, stage A to D, including changing in nomenclature around at-risk, pre-heart failure, symptomatic heart failure, and advanced heart failure. The ACC-AHA guidelines specifically discuss recommendations related to how we can best manage this early stage heart failure prior to symptomatic heart failure, incident heart failure onset, and detail a number of strategies that can be put forth and elevate the role of SGLT2 inhibitors in patients with type 2 diabetes at high cardiovascular risk, including those with established cardiovascular disease. I just want to point out, you know, I think this was such a welcome expansion in this clinical practice guidelines because, of course, focusing on this high-risk group of patients with established heart failure is of paramount importance in terms of health system value and reducing hospitalization risks for worsening heart failure. However, there's a large and substantial growing group of patients who are pre-heart failure or even at stage A early disease processes that is in the pipeline and is bound to expand have tremendous downstream consequences. And so I think focusing on this early stage heart failure population is really a welcome change in these guidelines.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. To really focus on, you know, the primary prevention space is such an added welcome addition. And, you know, I think just even changing the language can be helpful too, because, you know, instead of calling things, you know, stage A heart failure, stage B heart failure, the guidelines recommended that all these patients didn't have symptomatic heart failure by definition, and nomenclature was a little confusing. So trying to talk about stage A is at risk for heart failure or stage B is pre-heart failure, just that minor change in language, I think is welcome. And then I think, as you mentioned with SGLT2 inhibitors, you know, really a welcome addition in terms of strong evidence-based strategy to decrease the risk of developing heart failure in patients with type 2 diabetes. You know, it was good to see these in the ESC guidelines, you know, last year and now here, class 1, to decrease the risk of developing heart failure. And again, we remember this is a lot how the SGLT2 inhibitor story started in with respect to heart failure, you know, in those EMPA-REG and CANVAS, DECLARE, where we saw the reduction in heart failure hospitalization among patients with type 2 diabetes. That's where the story really started, and we need not forget that story. And now I'm really glad to have it in the class 1 for heart failure prevention.
So I am looking forward to future iterations because I think this entire pathway of how we prevent heart failure will continue to be developed. I think we have emerging evidence related to alternative pathways to heart failure, including chronic kidney disease. And I look forward to future iterations of guidelines actually building in specific risk reduction strategies for instant heart failure among at-risk patients with chronic kidney disease. We know the renin-angiotensin system inhibitors from the pivotal trials like RENAL and ID&T. We know the non-steroidal MRAs from the Fidelity program. And we know the SGLT2 inhibitors from trials like DAPA-CKD and CREDENCE and SCORED have powerfully modified incident heart failure risk in at-risk patients with chronic kidney disease. So these should be foundational in how we actually implement heart failure prevention strategies. Furthermore, in the pipeline, we know that trials like SELECT, which are large obesity programs, are specifically evaluating heart failure as important endpoints in anti-obesity therapies. So we'll see if we can actually broaden the pool of different pathways to incident heart failure and how we can actually place specific risk reduction strategies for each of those pathways.
Oh, very well said. And I think, as you mentioned, I do look forward to hopefully a substantial expansion of this section in the guidelines in future iterations with other therapies that are being trialed. So with that, though, I want to thank our audience for listening in on another episode of Don't Miss a Beat. And Mutu and I, once again, sincerely thank you for listening. I also want to remind our audience to remember you can find Don't Miss a Beat on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, and practicalcardiology.com, your home for the latest in clinically relevant news and information impacting cardiology. So with that, thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.